All right. So, we've looked at hero rats quickly before in terms of applications, but as we're at the end of our term, I thought we'd go back and take a look at a couple of things here. So, what do we think? Take other psychology courses. Where do rats rate in terms of, you know, favored pets or animals with many people? Relatively low, yeah, yeah. Not popular pets in a lot of North America, not allowed to have them in Alberta, but still, a lot of people find rats kind of creepy. Now, why is that? Why are rats more creepy, perhaps, than, oh, I don't know, weasels, i.e. ferrets? We may not know specifically, but probably this is something that's learned, right? It's probably an old association. It's been acquired. They eat grain. They carry bubonic plague. They just look creepy, you know, whatever it might be. All right. So one of the challenges that Hero Rats has got is trying to get people to adopt a rat, by which you give money and it helps the program go. But very few people want to give money to something that's creepy, right? So let's just take a look what they've done here. They've got four rats, so Blossom. Now take a look what they're doing at the Lang. Sweet young rat, okay? We talked about words and associations back with classical conditioning. You know, it's a sweet young rat. Well, you think of something that's sweet and young, that's nice, right? It's a nice rat, you know? It doesn't say Blossom, a vicious plague-carrying, baby-eating monster. No, we don't do that. So we choose our language very, very carefully. Elegant, yet determined. Honestly, I don't know if you'd really describe a rat as elegant yet determined, but still. Then take a look what else they've done here. They've added things, you know. They've turned this into like a personal ad, you know, right? Likes, making a nest out of wood chips, designer harnesses for the training fields, dislikes, landmines, ooh, wet grass under her feet. Okay, so it's very clever. It's very clever use of marketing. It ties in to things like with personal ads that people are familiar with. So, you know, it's a very nice marketing connection there. People get that, right? It uses positive-sounding things. What's the other thing? There's Cheeky. Here's Mojo. My kids and I adopted Mojo a little while ago. But let's take a look at Mojo's likes and dislikes. Romantic comedies. I mean, seriously, really? It's a rat, okay? I mean, I'll be the first one to go, is like, honestly, I mean, if there's not a peanut or a piece of banana in front of the television, I really doubt the rat's watching it. Okay, but that's not the point. From the marketing perspective, from getting people to make this association, you put up something like romantic comedies. What this has done is, we call it anthropomorphize the rat. It seems a bit more like a person. Even the fact that they're giving the rats names, right? Blossom, Mojo, Cheeky, what we do with our pets all the time, right? Now, this is not what usually happens with, say, laboratory rats or mice or pigeons or whatnot in psychology. We generally just, some professors give their lab animals names, but most just refer to them with a letter or number designation. Right? Because you actually may not want to make a close association. You may not want to make them seem like people or pets by giving them names in case you need to dissect their brains at some point later. Or if they suddenly die for whatever reason, you know, as much as you don't want that happening with your lab animals, maybe it's best not to get too attached to them. But in this case here, they're very consciously marketing in this in a way that it makes the rats seem personable. They seem nice. They have likes and dislikes. Doesn't like landmines. Well, okay. Mud on his paws. Doesn't like dirty paws. That's great. You know, that's kind of like cat-like. Ever watch cats? You know, they're lick their paws off, get clean. See, they're a clean animal. They're not dirty. So some very, very clever marketing components else. We see this. We see this in advertising all the time. We see it in politics, in anything where you're trying to essentially manipulate. Manipulation, when we say manipulate, we don't mean it has to be a bad manipulation, but you're trying to adjust people's attitudes. So they very carefully selected words and concepts and attitudes here. They're using conditioning. These are the principles that we have been going through during this course. All right, let's take a look at, let's have a little bit of fun here. So, anybody watch Big Bang Theory?
Are you finished?
Well, thank you. How thoughtful. Would you like a chocolate?
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Just for anyone that hasn't seen this show, that's been living under a rock for the last 5 years, we've got a bunch of geeks that are living in an apartment. Sheldon just stuffed candy into Penny's mouth. Penny's a girl. And it goes from here. Sheldon's, well, a bit of a jerk, actually, when it comes down to it. Very smart, but kind of jerk-like. Okay, so what I want you to do is watch this. This goes on for a little while. So give it a watch, and then we're going to talk about whether or not how they've depicted some conditioning here is really right, what they've got right, what they've got wrong.
What was that? We said be nice to Penny. I believe offering chocolate to someone falls within the definition of nice.
It does, but in my experience, you don't.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Yeah, now that's you, obnoxious and insufferable.
Oh, sorry, Sheldon, I almost sat in your spot.
Didn't you? I didn't notice. Have a chocolate.
Thank you. What's this cartoon called again?
Oshikubu Demon Samurai.
It's not a cartoon. It's anime.
Anime. You know, I knew a girl in high school named Anime. Anime Fletcher. She was born with one nostril. Then she had this bad nose job and basically wound up with three.
You're here a lot now.
Oh, am I talking too much? I'm sorry.
Thank you. Chocolate?
Yes, please.
Train my girlfriend like a lab rat.
Actually, it turns out I can.
Well, you shouldn't.
There's just no pleasing you, is there, Leonard? You weren't happy with my previous approach to dealing with her, so I decided you employ awkward conditioning techniques, building on the works of Thorndike and B.F. Skinner. Yet by this time next week, I believe I can have her jumping out of a pool, bouncing a beach ball on her nose.
No. This has to stop now.
I'm not suggesting we really make her jump out of a pool. I thought the bazinga was implied. We're just tweaking her personality. It's sanding off the rough edges, if you will.
No, you're not sanding Penny.
Are you saying that I am forbidden from applying a harmless, scientifically valid protocol that will make our lives better?
Yes, you're forbidden.
Bad, Leonard.
Oh. could they be talking about for so long?
Obviously, waitressing at the Cheesecake Factory is a complex socioeconomic activity that requires a great deal of analysis and planning. Bazinga. You know, using positive reinforcement techniques, I could train that behavior out of her in a week.
No.
Would you let me use negative reinforcement? I can get done before we go to bed.
You're not squirting her in the face with water.
No, of course not. We're talking very mild electric shocks. No tissue damage whatsoever.
Forget it!
Oh, come on. You can't tell me that you're not intrigued about the possibility of building a better girlfriend.
But I'm not! Well, Penny's qualities, both good and bad, are what make her who she is.
You mean like that high-pitched, irritating laugh?
Yes.
You wouldn't prefer a throaty chuckle?
You're not changing how Penny laughs.
No, that would be incongruous. I was going to lower the whole voice to a more pleasing register.
Oh, sorry, guys. That girl is freaky!
Come again?
Freaky.
Freaky?
Yeah, freaky.
Have a chocolate.
Thank you.
I'm going to make some warm milk and then turn in. I trust if you two are planning on engaging in amorous activities, you'll keep the decibel level to a minimum.
Of course.
Thank you.
You're so good.
Unbelievable.
What?
I was just thinking we should probably turn in too.
Well, my new bed got delivered. We'll work on it together if we stay at my place.
Maybe that's a lot of work and it's kind of late.
Yeah, but if we stay there, we won't have to be quiet.
Let's go.
Interesting. Sex works even better than chocolate to modify behavior. I wonder if anyone else has stumbled onto that.
Okay, so, was Sheldon doing it right? Sort of. What was one big thing that they got wrong?
You said that negative reinforcement
worked faster. Yeah, he said negative reinforcement worked faster. Right. What was Sheldon actually doing negative reinforcement there where he squirts Leonard? Talks about the electric shocks? No. He was actually doing what we presume would be a punisher. First off, it was a positive. Something was delivered. A spritz of water. So what he really meant was positive punishment. Right, especially the delivery of electric shocks, the squirting of water. Okay, so we talked about this before. This is the common one that even people in psychology, non-behavioral psychology, get wrong. They'll mix up negative reinforcement and positive punishment because the common usage of English, positive is good, negative is bad. But we don't use it that way. So, okay, leaving that aside, Would Sheldon have been right if he'd managed to get an appropriate punisher? You think maybe he could have done it faster? Votes for yes? I mean, these are all hypothetical. Yeah. Votes for no? And most people won't say anything at all because they think this is you're going to get graded on it? Yeah?
Well, I think it doesn't depend on, the appropriate punishment, but maybe
Yeah. Right. Sorry. When I said appropriate, I should have included as well having a
yes for intensity.
Right. And I'll count that as appropriate or quite right. Probably if it was an intense enough punisher, we could get back into what we've discussed as well. If you can start with an intense punisher, like remember the case with four electric shocks delivered to the self-injuring kid's child's leg, this reduced the behavior in only four presentations. So if done right, this. Yeah, if utilized correctly, punishers generally can reduce a behavior change behavior more rapidly than reinforcers can. But we also discussed all kinds of various risks there. What about what Sheldon's doing? So the idea is he wants to change Penny's behavior into what he sees as more appropriate. So how do you think this was, I mean, if this weren't just a television show, the way that Sheldon was doing this, could he have done something better here? Was there a problem in his approach? Let's try this. How many different, let's think about operational definitions. Okay? So Sheldon's using an operational definition of just making behaviors he doesn't like. So he's going to reinforce things that he likes. Okay, so is that a well-defined operational definition, or is it kind of a broad, open one? It's kind of broad, right? I mean, so think about all the things that he gave her chocolate for. I mean, not talking lower. So in one case, he's giving her reinforcement, he's giving her chocolate for not talking at all. Then he gives her chocolate for talking in a deeper voice. Do these maybe seem a little contradictory? So what have we done? Let's assume that he were to go with this. So he reinforces for not talking, then she talks, but as long as she talks lower, she gets chocolate as well. So we're now putting the non-talking schedule onto extinction. Now you can talk, but just talk lower. So one of the problems with what Sheldon's doing here is he's got all of these different behaviors, and he's not being consistent. So if you were to actually try to implement a protocol like this, you would probably have a lot of difficulty. This would not work particularly well or particularly quickly. So a better way, perhaps, for him to do this would have been to focus on a smaller set of behaviors, change one behavior at a time. Now, actual behavioral therapists, behavior modification folk, this is what they tend to do. They identify one or maybe a few behaviors that they need to modify or are seen important with respect to modification, and they work on those. Once those are under control or altered in the way they need to be, then they progress on to additional ones. Now, by doing this, it means they can generally shift those limited number of behaviors relatively rapidly, but you will have to keep going through them. So trying to do everything in one go is usually going to be fairly problematic. It may not work. What was another potential? Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Okay.
Because eventually she's going to either catch on or she's going to think this is going to go straight to my
house. Okay. Right. So she's either going to figure this out, perhaps, or she'll get worried about whether or not she's going to be gaining weight from the chocolate. She may even just satiate on the chocolate. I've had so much chocolate, I'm starting to feel sick, or I'm worried about my weight, or, yeah. So what should Sheldon probably have done here instead? Secondary reinforcers? Should have worked the secondary reinforcers in. So, yeah, I get a clicker. Or he did this, praise. Bring some praise in. Start pairing your praise with the chocolate initially. Then phase out the chocolate. Don't get the chocolate every time. Bring praise in. Occasionally use the chocolate. Do we think he could have actually gotten Penny to leap out of a swimming pool and balance a beach ball on her nose? Think about this in terms of preparedness. Is this something that people are particularly biologically prepared to do? Probably not. So, I mean, possibly, but that would have been difficult. That would have required some very specific shaping. Possible to do, but Not an easy one. How about the changing, even just the changing of the voice, changing the voice registry, going from her normal speaking voice down to a much lower one? Again, that can be conditioned, that can be done, but again, if her natural speaking voice is higher, probably going to have a certain preparedness, biological potential that is pushing back towards that. So it can be done probably to some extent, but perhaps not fully. Maybe changing the laugh may actually have been easier. So anyways, kind of fun. There's some stuff there. So they've got the idea of operant conditioning here. And they've got some broad ideas right. They've got a lot of details wrong. And this is one of the interesting things. For anybody that goes on and works in applied behavioral psychology, this is a very common problem that they get into, is the public has this very different idea of how the application of the science, the psychology, actually works. And it is not uncommon for behavioral therapists to get into problems with, say, friends or family members working at cross purposes with the therapist. So, in fact, one of the things that's not commonly done is you have to essentially teach the people that are sort of in contact with your patient some basics of this. Okay, don't do this. This is how we're going to do it. You must do it in this particular way. Otherwise, they can actually defeat a lot of the principles that are being brought in. So, anyways, just some fun stuff there. Any questions on that? No. All right. Let us continue here. So, chapter 11. Chapter 11 takes us into discussion of forgetting. Now, we've actually brought up the concept of forgetting very early on in the course, especially in the context of talking about extinction. So he said extinction is not the same thing as forgetting. Extinction is actually a learning process, either in classical conditioning or operant conditioning. You are learning a new contingency. Forgetting is rather different. Forgetting is a loss of memory due to, well, various features. Now, there's various ways that different psychologists, people in different sort of areas of psychology, talk about memory. The sort of common terminology used now is that it's an internal record or an internal representation of some sort of past experience. Right? An important thing to remember is this record, this representation, isn't necessarily going to be the same as what really happened. It may not be a complete representation of the original. It may be actually completely in error. So, in the movie Casablanca, consistently rated as one of the best movies of all times, what's the famous line? Everyone knows it. Play it again, Sam. Right? Everyone's heard that, yeah? Never says play it again, Sam. He says play it, Sam. It's a false memory. I mean, it's not an important false memory, right? It's not like whether you think you were abducted by aliens or something. Okay, it's not very important, but that's an example. This has been bandied about in pop culture for so long, you know, play it again, Sam, that very few people go back to the original movie. And even when they see the movie, they've had so many other uses of this in various other pop culture references, sitcoms, other movies, whatnot, that people know the wrong line better than they know the actual real line. Okay? So, that would be a false memory. It's not exactly the right representation of the actual experience. False memories go from, you know, that, sort of the ultra banal, into the rather extreme memories of potentially real or not real things that happened during childhood and whatnot. From everything we know about psychology, for example, episodic memories cannot be retained until after a child is at least about 2 years old. So people that claim that they actually have memories from being in the womb or of their birth process, Ray Bradbury, who passed away last week, a great American fantasy author, or just novelist in general, claimed that he thought he had memories from being in the womb. These are false memories. They do not exist. Or people remembering what their first or possibly even second birthday party was like. I remember it exactly. It's like, no, you don't. What you probably remember is people subsequently describing the stuff that happened at that birthday party, or possibly seeing photographs of it or videos, and then turning that into a memory. Everything we know from everybody who has been studied about this, specific episodic memories do not encode, or at least cannot be retrieved, encoded, generally until after kids are after about, older than about 2 years of age. Okay? So these then become false memories. And again, in many cases, most false memories are not that important, right? You forget something, or you're sure you were supposed to get something on the shopping list, you get it, and it's like, oh, I didn't actually need 4 bricks of butter after all. Whatever it happens to be. Okay. Now, take a cognitive psychology course. You'll go into huge detail about the ways that experiences are going to be stored, how they're going to be retrieved, these sorts of issues, different types of memory, whatnot. And if you go into a cognitive neuroscience course, they'll talk to you in great detail about the hippocampal formation and how memories get stored and the effects of different neurotransmitters and whatnot. The comparative psychology approach, that is the learning behavioral psychology approach, looks at it in a rather different way. Part of this is because the foundations of comparative psychology go back well before there was the ability to record from single neurons or have MRIs that would let you know what's happening in the hippocampus in terms of blood flow, these sorts of things. So the comparative psychologist looks at memory in terms of whether or not an experience has the ability to alter an organism's behavior under certain circumstances. As such, this is stimulus control. All right, so in the presence of particular stimuli, what behavior do you do? What's the outcome going to be? So in essence, what we talked about in chapter 10 really factors into the way that the behavioral psychologist interprets memory. So, what's forgetting going to be? Well, forgetting is going to be a deterioration in learned behavior after a period of time passes without engaging in continual practice. So, again, we're defining this behaviorally. Okay, we're going to look at a change in the behavior. In this case here, change of behavior following a passage of time. Okay, so again, this is different from extinction. There are various ways that one can measure forgetting, but all of these share a certain commonality. You have to go through some sort of training period. You can't forget something that you've never actually somehow experienced before, right? So we have to go through a training period, a learning period, an acquisition phase, however short that may be. Okay, so we have that. Then you wait for some period of time pass. This is called the retention interval, and then you test. See whether or not the behavioral performance has changed from before the retention interval to after the retention interval. Okay, now, as I said, there's different particular techniques that can be used here. First of these is called the free recall method. You train, you go through your acquisition, you wait, there's your retention interval, you test. Pretty straightforward. Essentially, this is what happens with our exams, right? You will be studying the exam on Thursday, 3 to 5 o'clock, be here, unless you are one of the few people that are in arrangements because you're taking multiple courses in the same time. I have to write a little bit earlier, but for most of you, you'll be writing here Thursday afternoon. You will have been studying up until some point before the exam. There's going to be some period of time, retention interval, where you're not studying before you get to a question you need to know. And, well, actually, I'm sorry. Actually, in fact, this isn't exactly a free recall. My apologies. We're actually a bit of a prompted recall. We'll get to that in a moment. But you are having to recall something. Now, if I just said, what's the unladened wind speed of an African swallow? If anyone knows Monty Python, you'll get that. If I just said, what's that, and you had to come up with an answer, that would be free recall. Okay? Or if I just said, tell me everything that you know about shaping, that's free recall. The name of the dude who stuck cats in little boxes that they had to get out of was Thorndike. Okay? That's free recall. They're very much an all or nothing kind of test here. Now, this may not be particularly great in terms of testing people's ability to remember complicated tasks, maybe multiple steps that are needed, various things like this. Some elements may be remembered, but not others. But if you're missing one or two elements, that means you may not be able to actually complete the memory task. And so you may, couldn't do it. Couldn't do it, must have forgotten. It's like, no, maybe you only forgot a little bit of it, but that means the task can't be done. Here's a 1974 Chevy engine, put it back together. Okay. You left out the carburetor, you got it wrong, boom, you failed. Got everything else right. Okay, from a free recall perspective, that would be forgetting. Now, sorry, what we're actually doing with a multiple choice exam is what's called prompted or cued recall. So, blah, 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 question, blah, 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 dude who stuck cats in little boxes was Abraham Lincoln, Edward Thorndike, B.F. Skinner, I don't know, Crocodile Dundee, whatever. That's prompted. We're not just asking you to yank Thorndike's name out of, I don't know, where in your brain, someplace in there. Go talk to a cognitive neuroscientist. They'll probably tell you. But we're giving you some hints. We're giving you some cues. Now, that's one way of looking at cued recall. It's multiple choice. There's another way. Used to be actually a lot of research here done at the U of A in terms of navigation, spatial representation, how people got lost. Anyone gotten lost in the biosciences building? Yeah. We actually have, in fact, used it to do human studies in spatial representation, so we see whether or not people get lost in it. We actually haven't found everybody. So if you stumble upon some bones someplace, just, you know, please just kind of push them out of the way and pretend you didn't see them. No. We have used the biosciences building for this, but one of the ones that was commonly done, we had a couple of researchers here that were interested in how children would get lost. And this has huge implications for search and rescue, because kids are often the ones that get lost and wander off. One of the things they discovered actually very quickly was that kids can actually motor a lot faster than people had previously thought. By the time a kid hits about age 5, they're like the little Energizer bunnies. They'll just keep going and going and going. And I mean, on average, some kids won't. But, I mean, like, they did one study where it was like, okay, can you take us to the furthest place away you can think of? And, you know, most of the kids, you know, would do something relatively close. But, you know, a few kids, it's just like, okay, come on. And they start walking and walking. And, you know, after like an hour and a half, it's like, where are we going? To my grandma's house. The phone. okay. Here's the kid. You know, she's taking him to grandma. Where's grandma's house? Northeast Edmonton? It's like, yeah, and the kid's like, I'm just going to walk to Northeast Edmonton. Yeah, just so, used to be thought that the kids, if they get lost, they won't go very far outside of their neighborhood. Apparently not. Anyways, so one of the things that they do on campus here with kids is they'd see how kids get lost on campus. So they'd start from Bioscience Building, and for example, one of the things you do is say, okay, we're going to play a little game. We're going to do sort of a follow the leader, and the researcher would lead the kid across campus on a particular route. So, whatever. Eventually, say, ending up over by the Fine Arts Building. And then researcher could say, okay, your turn. I want you to lead me back. Okay, I'll follow you now. You take me back to where we started from. Now, if you're doing a free recall test, that's why you just let the kid lead you. And if they get back, they've succeeded. They've remembered. If they don't get back to the biosciences building, they failed. They don't remember. But in a prompted or cued recall, what the researcher will do that's accompanying the child is if the child looks to be confused, if the child pauses someplace at an intersection and sort of seems to be having a hard time remembering where they should go, the researcher can go, would you like a hint? Anytime you need a hint, ask me and I can give you a hint. Okay, so these are prompts. It's like, yeah, I need a hint. Should I go that way, this way, or that way? We should go that way. Okay, so count up the number of hints or prompts that are required. If the child needs no prompts, okay, that's excellent memory. No forgetting. If they need one prompt, there's been a certain amount of forgetting. If they need 12 prompts, been a lot of forgetting. Okay, so prompted or cued recall. The other thing with that, this one's very interesting, is you can see what part of the task needs prompting, right? Did they remember the section that was close to the Biosci building? So if they remember this, but you know, they've got problems when they're getting towards, you know, coming back from the fine arts. Maybe they need some prompting there, but the rest of it they're good on. So which parts are more difficult to remember than others, or almost been forgotten more? Okay. So very interesting things you can do with that. The relearning method. So we go through our initial acquisition, we go through retention, and then what we're going to do is we're going to reinstate, we're going to go through another acquisition or reacquire the behavior. So you go through your acquisition, you get up to whatever level of performance you want, say asymptotic performance. Okay. Then after the retention interval, you're going to start doing some more training, and you're going to count the number of, say, trials or the number of time, whichever is more appropriate here, it takes to get back up to that same level of performance from before the retention interval. If first trial after the retention interval, the subject's doing as well as they were before the retention interval, there's been no forgetting. If it takes four more trials of retraining to get back up to previous level of ability, okay, that's telling us something about the degree of forgetting. Now remember, these aren't necessarily absolutes. Okay, so I mean, it's not telling us how many neural connections have broken down or how much neurotransmitter needs to be released again or whatnot. These are sort of relative, you know. If one person needs four more trials and another person needs six more trials, we're sort of in a comparison range here. These are, remember we talked about relational versus absolute? Kind of dealing with more of a relational form of comparison here. Recognition. So recognition method. Subject only has to identify whether or not they've been exposed to this material, whatever material it is before. So can you distinguish between an original stimulus and distractors? Things that you may or may not have, you know, things you've perhaps seen before, things that you perhaps have not. Okay? So if you've seen some of this stuff before, then you throw in, so it's like, okay, here's a red square. Now we're going to toss in some other squares, maybe a couple of them be the same size but different shades of red, and maybe one of them is going to be the same shade of red but a different size. Can you pick out the original square? Okay, recognition. If you can't, you haven't remembered it particularly well, or you've forgotten something, or whatnot. So again, stimulus control. Which stimulus were you trained on? Hey, we've already seen this one. Delayed matching the sample. So we go through an acquisition period. We present the sample. Some time passes. We wait. Then, can you remember? And here's a prompting. Was it green or was it red? Prompting. Okay. So that's a very commonly used one with, say, pigeons or rats in operant chambers. Very easy to implement and set up. The extinction method. Take two subject groups, two groups of subjects. Train them up. Okay? Give them the same amount of training. We're going to put both groups onto extinction. One of the groups, though, is going to have a retention interval put in between the training and the extinction. The other one won't. Okay, so we do some classical conditioning. So we do, for all the subjects in the two groups, get 50 trials, the CS paired with the US. First group, immediately after we get through our 50 trials, they then move on to extinction. So now it's just CS by itself, CS by itself, CS by itself. And we see how many presentations of the conditional stimulus it takes before we no longer get a conditional response. Count those up. Second group, 50 pairings between the CS and the US. Then we're going to do a retention interval. We'll wait for 10 minutes, 2 hours, 3 days, whatever it is, whatever the retention interval is. Then we'll do the extinction. CS, no US. CS, no US. And we'll count the number of extinction trials it takes before, again, we get down to no conditional response. Compare. If there has been forgetting, we will expect it will take fewer trials until we have extinction in our second group, in the group that had the retention interval put in. So that's going to be a measure of the degree of forgetting that has occurred. We talked about generalization gradients. We can utilize those in measuring forgetting. So set up your stimulus control, go through your discrimination training, and then do your testing for generalization gradient. Use probe trials or extinction blocks, whatever you're going to use. And just keep doing it and see, you know, come back after various times. So do some sampling, put in a retention interval, see what happens, come back, do some more sampling, put another retention interval in, come back, do some more sampling. Okay, so you can check your generalization gradients over time. Now, if our generalization gradient is going to go from, you know, having a nice sort of peak on or around your discriminant stimulus or your CS, if it starts to flatten, then that becomes a measure of forgetting. Subject essentially is forgetting what the stimulus control is. What was it I was supposed to be paying attention to? I don't know. I can't remember exactly. Everything, I can't remember. It was a light, I think. Remember what color of light? Nope. Light. All right. So another measure of forgetting there. So, which should you use? Which is best? Depends. Depends on what you're doing. In cases of navigation or complex tasks, yeah, prompted recall may be kind of important. If, you know, it's like, can this person manage to program their DVD recorder? Oh, no, they couldn't do it. The show didn't record. They have forgotten. Well, maybe they only forgot one step. Which step is it? Well, we test a whole bunch of people. If you find out it's the same step that they need prompting on, it's like, okay, maybe we should, like, redesign that DVD recorder because apparently this thing is really hard to remember to do. Everything else is easy. It's just this one step. If you get interested in industrial organizational psychology, this is the kind of stuff that becomes important. You can actually get good jobs from doing IO psych, right? Corporations want to know what is going to make the use of cars, audio equipment, you name it, whatever it is, filling out your tax forms, whatever it happens to be, what's going to make it easier? What's going to lead to less cognitive dissonance? What's going to lead to less stress, less frustration? The happier people are about the process, the more likely they are to do it, the more likely they are to buy it. Okay, so these are the kinds of things that somebody working in IO psychology may be doing as testing. So they may want not just an all or nothing measure of forgetting, but they may very much want these prompts to see where the process specifically breaks down. In that case, yeah, you're probably going to want a prompted recall. If you're doing just a straight-up sort of memory degradation over time, you know, the delayed matching to sample. Again, it's a prompted recall, but it's a very, very simple one. And if you're using, say, pigeons as a model for more complex memory processes in humans, that may be great. Maybe that's all you need. Go with that. Okay, so different ways to do it. One technique isn't necessarily any better or worse than another. It depends specifically on what you're interested in. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the retention interval here. I just sort of mentioned that this is the time between your initial learning and then your subsequent testing. All other things being equal, a little bit of a hedged statement here, but all other things being equal, the greater the interval, so the greater the retention interval, the less that is retained, or flip side of that is the more you have forgotten. Now, the thing about this is, though, from the perspective of behavioral psychology, learning psychology, time in and of itself isn't an event. In and of itself, time doesn't really do anything. Time isn't causal. Time is correlated. The passage of time correlates with other things happening during that time. So we do these this sort of construct thingy here. So it's the passage of time that causes you to forget. Well, not really. It's the stuff that happens during that passage of time that leads to forgetting. And so from the scientific perspective, the real question here is, what are the actual causal factors? What's happening during the retention interval, that passage of time, that is involved in the forgetting process? And there's various things we can look at. So, for example, we've mentioned overlearning, discovered by Ebbinghaus back in the 19th century. So what Ebbinghaus did was, remember, he had his list of nonsense words, consonant, vowel, consonant words, made-up words, and he'd learn a list of them, and then he'd wait some time and go back and see whether or not he could repeat the list. What Ebbinghaus found was that if, even once he'd gotten to perfect recall, if he continued to read through the list a few more times, that is, he was, quote-unquote, overlearning, he would retain the material for longer. Okay, so this gives us some information here as well. It's not just the passage of time that causes forgetting, because there's these things that can be altered before we hit the retention interval that play a role. So, yeah, you've got perfect performance, you've perfect recall on it, you're doing the task at asymptote, whatever. But if you don't just stop then, if you continue doing the training, you'll retain this longer. Now, I should say, there will be a point of diminishing returns, okay? It's like, well, if reading the chapter over one more time increased my ability to remember this, reading the chapter another 396 times should mean I'll remember it forever. Yeah, possibly, but do you really need to remember the chapter forever? Probably not. So at some point, you know, you're really not going to gain that much more out of continual overlearning. But it does point out that what's happening before the retention interval is also getting involved in this. So again, just saying it's not time itself. Prior learning. we know that meaningful material is easier to retain than random material. Anybody done any martial arts like karate or judo or whatnot? A few people? Okay. In a lot of the martial arts, there's, let me see the Japanese term, there's a technique called katas. Katas are, it's sort of like shadow boxing. You go through a series of moves, you know, this lets you practice them, and you eventually get tested on them to see if you get up to a different color belt or whatnot. Anyway, so the katas are a series of martial arts moves you do. There may be anything from maybe 5 or 6 moves up to maybe 60 or 80 moves. So these may be very long, complicated processes. One of the things about this is the ones that have like 60 or 80 moves can be really hard to remember. But what makes it easier for many people is to put it into a story. Instead of just going, I do this move, I block high, then I turn to my left, I kick low. Since the instructor say, okay, let's imagine that you're in an actual fight. Now, why are you having to go back and forth? Okay, you've been attacked by 3 dudes, and they've got, like, one of them's got a pipe wrench that he's going to smack your head in with, the other one's carrying a knife, and yada, yada. Okay, so they come at you from 3 directions. So you block the first one, you turn to the second one, you kick his knee out, you then turn back to the first one who's doing a swing at you with his pipe wrench, block low, take the elbow up, and so on. It says, once you turn it into a story, and you know, you can sort of visualize the story, it becomes a lot easier to remember. Okay. Opera singers. A lot of opera singers, not all, but many people that continue on in things like opera singing will actually learn 3, 4 different languages. Right? Why? You may have a 2.5 hour long, or if you're doing Wagner, you know, like 3 day long series, the Germans, opera performance. If you don't actually know the words to this, what the words and the things that you're singing actually mean, you have to remember a whole bunch of just random syllables. But if you know what the words mean, this becomes a lot easier. Actually know what's going on. Okay. In fact, actually, for a lot of North American opera houses discovered this, going back about 20 years now, when they started putting digital displays up over the stage that, you know, would tell who was singing, you know, Figaro, you know, sing, oh my goodness, I can't believe you're here, you know, sort of thing. It's like, oh, that's what he's talking about. Yeah. And people started, you had a lot more people that would sing, go to opera, you know, or it was like, it's okay, the music's nice, but I have no idea what's going on, so it's kind of boring. So they put up the captions. It's like, oh, yeah, that makes more sense. Okay, that's cool. Right. So attendance went up. People had more satisfying experience. So if you understand what's going on, it's going to be easier to remember. So prior learning comes into this as well. Classic little study on it, beautifully elegant. As well, De Groot, 1966. He had chessboard. Okay. Now, in the game of chess, if you don't know how to play chess, simply say that there's different pieces on the board, and the pieces can move in very specific ways. Because of this, there will be legal arrangements of pieces on the board and illegal arrangements. So, for example, you can't have one of the types of pieces is called a bishop. You can't have both of your bishops on the same color squares on the grid. All right. If you have that, you've got an illegal placement. Something's gone wrong there. All right. So what he did was De Groot got chess masters, people that were really, really good at playing chess, and chess novices, people that have really done almost no chess before. He set up a chess board, didn't put all of the pieces on, but put a few pieces on, in an arrangement, and let the subjects, both the chess masters and the novices, observe the arrangement on the board for 5 seconds. Okay, just 5 seconds. Then De Groot goes, ha-ha! knocks all the pieces off the chessboard. I'm quite convinced that part of the fun of this was being able to get into a chess master's face and go, ha-ha, and knock everything off. It's got to be a certain amount of satisfaction there. Anyway, he says, yeah, put them back. Well, it turns out the chess master's is like, ha-ha, yourself, buddy. They did pretty well. They got this the arrangement back about 90% of the time. Novices, only about 40% of the time. Okay, so we get into an interesting question here, just from this study. So we can see that, yes, chess masters are better at this. Now, one assumption we could make is we could say, yeah, well, that's probably because they've had a lot more experience with playing chess. Maybe, but there is an alternative possibility here. Maybe you become a chess master because your brain is just wired for chess. Maybe you have some innate processes here, genetic processes, that make it really unlikely that you're going to forget the positions of little wooden pieces on a grid arrangement. You have some freakish ability here that means you're not going to forget how things are placed on the board. And so people that have that, you know, unusual spatial arrangement ability, lack of forgetting of spatial places on a game board, they just do better in the game, and so they become chess masters. Right? It's kind of like what we talked about with violence in television. Right? If you, as an adult, watch violent programming, is that because you were exposed to violent programming as a kid, or you're just a violent person, and consequently violent programming is more interesting to you? All right. Why do women, you know, why do we more typically see, along with Mojo the Rat, romantic comedies being more popular with women than men? Is it because women have a predisposition towards liking romantic comedies, or is this due to some sort of enculturation process? In the case of the rat, I'm not sure on that one. That one's just weird. Okay, so this becomes the question. Is it prior experience or some sort of innate retention ability in terms of their brains? Enter Chase and Simon a few years later. Same sort of process here. Except in this case, they utilize, I should say, DeGroote put his chess pieces in legal arrangements. Everything was proper. It was like as if you were playing a real game of chess. Chase and Simon put their pieces randomly on the board. So some of these pieces are going to be in illegal positions. Right? You may have two bishops on the same color, either a black or a white square. They may both be on black. You can't have that. So when they did this, they found that in this case, chess masters were no better than novices at recalling the placement of the pieces. Okay. So it seems here that what actually makes chess masters better in DeGroote's study is the past experience. It's not that their brains are just better at remembering spatial arrangements. It seems it's because they have played thousands and thousands of games of chess, and they've probably seen every conceivable legal placement of pieces on the board over and over and over again. Lots of experience there. But when you put them in random, illegal places, they're not very familiar with those. Or at least they're no more familiar than your novices are. And so they do about the same. So again, prior experience there. Now, again, if you were to take a cognitive psychology course, you'd probably go into this in a lot more detail. But we'll just sort of touch on this here. So concept called proactive interference. Pro from before. So we also get in cases where previous learning can actually interfere with subsequent recall. There's a methodology that can be utilized to test this. It's called the paired associate learning protocol, or the technique. So the PAL protocol, or the PAL technique. Your subjects learn paired lists. They then are tested with one item from a list and have to recall the next item from the next list. You can number the lists, you can give the list names, whatever it is. I'm just going to use letters here for simplicity. Okay? So let's say we've got three lists, A, B, and C. All right, I'll put up a little table with this in just a moment. Okay, so three lists, A, B, C. all of her subjects are going to learn the A list and the C list. So everybody has to go through a learning process on A and C. However, some of our subjects, like our group two subjects, will have previously learned an A, B list. So group one subjects learn A and C, then go on to testing. Group two subjects learn the A list paired with the B list words, and then they're exposed to the A list and the C list, and then they go on to testing. So in testing, they'll be provided with the A list words, and they have to recall what the corresponding C list word was. What we find is those subjects that had previously been exposed to training with an A-B list have more difficulty. They have a harder time recalling C when given A. So let's just look at an example here. So our control group, let's take our control group first here, they basically start with phase two. So control group, here's our, just for simplicity, our A list words have A's. Let's start with A's. So apple, Arbor, Adam, and then C list, Home, Car, Cod, Free. So they're paired up, they're presented together, right? Simultaneous presentation, so apple and comb, aardvark and car, Adam and cod, ants and cream, then phase three. And incidentally, you could put in a retention interval here if you wanted to. So we can, the PAL technique is very flexible. We could stick in a retention interval at this point if we wanted to. So then phase three, they're given the A word, so apple, and it's like, what was the C word that went with that? Aardvark, and so on and so on. So we're checking to see how much they remember. Our experimental group here, though, first, so they have an additional phase tossed in at the front. So A words, same A words, but here's a B list. So apple is paired with ball, aardvark with birch, Adam with banana, ant with bomb. Then they go into our A and C list, so apple, comb, arbor, car, Adam, cod, and cream. And then they get tested with the A words, and can they recall the C? What we find is our experimental group has more difficulty recalling C's when presented A. It seems that their initial learning of the A-B, our paired A-B list, interferes, hence proactive prior interference. Right? So things that you've learned before can cause subsequent difficulties. Anybody remember what this is kind of like from classical conditioning? Starts with a B. Thank you, blocking. Well done. See the little starts with a B? That's called prompting, right?
Yeah.
Okay. See, this all comes together in the lecture? Just let me out. Okay, fine. Let us continue. All right. Yeah, this is very similar to what we encountered in terms of blocking, right? If you've learned that a particular CS is a good predictor of a particular US, do you really need to pay attention to subsequent conditional stimuli? Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but it's harder to do. Hard to learn that. You've already made these prior associations. Made these prior associations here. Levine and Murphy demonstrated proactive interference in a rather interesting little real-worldish type study. They looked at it with not lists of words, but with attitudes. So this was happening in, it was published in 43, so they're probably collecting the data in either early 43 or 1942. So we're in the middle of the Second World War here. What they had students do, university students, was read pro-communism passages, like little newspaper article passages, or anti-communism passages, so snippets they took out of newspaper articles. What they found was that students who held prior pro-communistic attitudes, in other words, before they went through this whole study, they gave them a little questionnaire and said, you know, on a scale of 1 to 7, how would you rate your opinions of the following things? You know, they throw in a few distractors, you know, bananas, 6, you know, communism, 3, turtles, 2, fascism, seven, whatever. Okay, so you do the scale. Okay. What they found was there was a correlation here. Students that indicated that they were pro-communism, they thought communism was okay, they forgot. They were less likely to remember the anti-communistic elements in the passages they read. They were more likely to remember the pro-communism stuff. And vice versa. Those students that held anti-communism attitudes were more likely to forget the pro stuff that they read, but hang on to the anti, the against communism message. Now, this shows a few things. It's showing, first off, that attitudes aren't going to be innate. You know, you're not born having a particular political orientation there, or at least not in any sort of big way. This is probably due to your prior learning. However these students acquired their pro- or anti-communism attitudes, this is what they got from prior experience, prior up. So we get this in politics even here today. So we went through an Alberta election recently. Depending what attitudes people have coming into the election, they are more likely to remember the stuff that agrees with their attitudes. So, I mean, your background or experience said that led you to be a supporter of the PC party, more likely to retain stuff that agrees with PC party platform, less likely to retain material that says, whoops, the PC has been doing something wrong. Conversely, you know, same thing, liberal, retain the pro stuff, kind of forget about the anti. But the liberals have done this wrong. Yeah. What about the students that didn't have any particular sway one way or the other? Then it's just sort of a random. Then we just get into, that's an excellent question. If you don't come into this with any particular strong attitudes or attitudes whatsoever, right? You know, it's like, you know, on a scale of 1 to 7, you know, if you're like middle of the road, you're kind of unbiased in this respect. You have no prior experience to it, and so it's just going to be a straight retention interval process. How much do you actually remember? How much do you forget? So we're not going to have that sort of blocking effect. So we get this. So this is, in marketing advertising, this is sometimes called brand loyalty. Once brand loyalties are established, they become very hard to break. So if, you know, your parents, you know, you have fond memories with your parents of drinking Coca-Cola, you know, with them at the beach or on vacation or at home or at birthday parties or whatever it is. You know, if you subsequently find out, someone says, you know, Coca-Cola is made from extracting, you know, juices out of the liver of baby seals. It's like, I didn't hear that. Right. You're less likely to remember that sort of thing. I mean, it's like, I don't think that's... what? But it's so delicious. It's made by polar bears at the North Pole. I'm sure of it. So, anyways, a fairly facetious example there. But brand loyalty. Once you establish loyalty, my neighbors, for example, neighbor, family, they've got kids, and... one of them, when the youngest of them, when he turned 18, it's like, yeah, you know, Trevor, he was looking for, he wanted to get a truck. It's like, well, I know someone that's got a, you know, really nice little Toyota, a few years old, you know, wants to get rid of it, not too expensive. And it's like, oh, yeah, Trevor's probably not going to go with the Toyota. I mean, his dad's driven Fords. His grandfather drove Fords. He really wants a Ford. Seriously? Because are you sure that you want to, okay, right? It's like, but it's, well, all right, you can take a look at my friend's Toyota or not. It's cheap, it's good truck, but whatever, fine. Brand loyalty. Grandfather drove Fords, father drove Fords, I drive a Ford. Even if Fords suck. And I'm not saying they do or don't for trucks. I mean, honestly, you know, I mean, I mentioned during this course, looking at cars and trucks and vans and stuff, and yeah, have the Ford F-150, took a look at this, it was in contention there with the Supercab, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. My grandfather knew Henry Ford. He worked on the assembly line in Detroit. Doesn't mean I'm going to buy a Ford. But still, okay, once you've got a brand loyalty that's established, these are like the proactive interference. Even if people are telling you, it's like, you know, it's not really very good for you. Probably shouldn't do this, or there's something better out there, or it's got a poor environmental record, or blah, blah, blah. The retinal display on the new MacBook Pro, the retinal screen, it's made from the retinas of baby seals. I would be really intrigued if it was actually made from retinas. I'm less excited about the retina displays. You don't follow stuff that's happening with computer technology, you can ignore that. But if you have prior experiences, they will interfere. All other things being equal, they're more likely to interfere with subsequent learning. You hold political views, food choice views, religious views, what's the best car views, whatever they are, however you acquired those, that's essentially a brand loyalty. It's proactive interference. Okay. Now, just to make things more complicated, we can have interference from before, if you've learned stuff before, but we can also get interference from subsequent learning. Okay? So, nice little study done where they gave subjects the training, so they go through the training period, and then subjects broken into two groups, randomly assigned to two different groups. First group of subjects just is like, okay, now go to sleep. You know, go take a rest, go get some sleep, okay? Second group, it's like, yeah, you got to stay awake for the next 8 hours. Now, what happens here is some of the subjects get sampled every hour then. So it's like, you know, you got your, say, I don't know, 100 subjects that are awake, and, you know, every hour the researchers go into the room and, you know, drag some out and go, all right, you know, time to do some testing, and they give them a retention. The memory test, forgetting test. Similarly, the ones that are asleep, you know, every hour, some of them get woken up and dragged out to do the testing there. What they find is those subjects that were sleeping, they forget less than those that are awake. Now, it seems that what we can extract out of this, at least in part, is that those subjects that are awake, they're being continually exposed to new stuff. You know, whatever it is they're doing during the remainder of those, you know, the 8 hours that they're awake, they're learning some new stuff, they're seeing some new stuff, they're, whether they want to or not, they're making more associations. Right? The subjects that are asleep, I mean, sure, I mean, they're having some dreams and, you know, a little bit of stuff, you know, like a door slamming might percolate its way into their brain and, you know, get incorporated into a dream, dragon farting or something. I don't know what your dreams are like. Okay. You don't like dragons, unicorns, okay, whatever it happens to be. Right? But, I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say here that our subjects that are sleeping through this period are experiencing less, they're learning less than those that are awake. So we've got this sort of retrograde or retroactive interference. You learn this stuff, and if you don't really learn anything else after that, your retention's not bad. If you learn the stuff and then you learn a bunch of other stuff, it's going to be harder to retain. So, it's called retroactive interference. It's when subsequent learning interferes with the recall of prior learned material. Again, we can utilize the PAL technique for this, the paired associative learning technique here. In this case, all subjects learn your AC words, but then one of the groups is going to learn an AB list. Test the subjects, give them the A words, see if they can recall the C. In this case here, we find those that subsequently learn the AB list have worse recall for the C as well. Same setup here, okay, except in both cases in phase. Phase one is the AC, so we start with this, Apple, Co, Marker, Car, Adam, Cod, and Cream. Same thing for our control group here, same list. Control group gets a pass, no phase two. We just sort of hang around for however long phase two takes for the experimental group there. Experimental group then goes through the AB words, apple, ball, aardvark, bark, atom, banana, and bomb. And then both groups get tested with the A words and see if they can recall the Cs. Control group does better than our experimental. Okay? So in this case, retroactive interference, what you've learned subsequently, interferes with what you learned before. Okay. Let's take a break. Okay. Spot on 12 o'clock. So come on back in 10 minutes, and we will continue.